Eh bien, je vous propose de commencer le séminaire. Et pour cette sixième session, j'ai invité le grand plaisir de recevoir Predrag Petrovic du Karolinska Institute. Nous recevions la semaine dernière Henrik Ersson, également du Karolinska Institute. Ce sont deux jeunes chercheurs qui disposent à présent de leur propre équipe au Karolinska. And so today, let me just introduce Predrag Petrovic. Who is a researcher but also a doctor in psychiatry, working towards a specialization in psychiatry. He got his PhD in 2002 and he has been working under the supervision of Martin Invar in the Karolinska Institute, but also made, like I would say many researchers in Europe, an important stay at UCL, University College London, Queen Square, working on with the cognitive neuroscience group there. And he's a very original researcher, I think, in his ability to combine his interest in psychiatry, medicine, and cognitive science, and tackling one of the most interesting problems, which is why the placebo effect works. I think he will tell us more about this, so I don't want to spoil the fun. I will just give the title, Expectation, Beliefs and the Origins of the Placebo Effect. Predrag, thank you.
Thank you. Oops. All right. Thank you very much for inviting me to Collège de France. It's an honor to be here. And as everyone can see in the background here, we have a little clip from the movie The Matrix. And in this movie, of course, our hero has to choose in between a blue pill and a red pill in order to experience two completely different realities. And also this talk is about the brain and reality, and we're talking about expectations and beliefs and how they interact with what we call the placebo effect. All right, so already several hundred years ago, philosophers like Descartes could describe that we actually have a neural system that can mediate input towards the brain. And thereby, we could feel pain, we could see things around us. By the way, I have to say, Descartes has, for you that don't know that, has this very special association with Sweden. He did all his fantastic work here, then he went to Sweden, got depressed, and died. So I hope that's not the what will happen to all scientists moving to Sweden. Well, anyway, the question is the brain really a mirror of the outer world? Or is the real world very, very, very different from how we experience it? If you would ask cognitive neuroscientists like Professor Dehaene, he would probably, or they would probably say that it's somewhere in the middle. So we always have input signals reaching the brain, but also constantly we have knowledge, goals and expectations that will interact with these processes. And I will give you an example of this. And I've seen the previous speakers here at this seminar, so I know you've seen this, but I still think it's a good example of how expectations can change how you experience the world. All right, you've seen this? So this is called the hollow mask illusion, and it builds on the idea that we are social creatures and faces are extremely important for us. So if something is almost a face but not a real face, we will turn it into a face because that suits our expectations quite good. So this fantastic small experiment by Richard Gregory in University of Bristol, for that you only need a hollow mask and you start turning it slowly. And of course you have features of a face like a nose sticking out, and then we will see soon what happens in the hollow part of the mask. And as you can see, a face starts growing out with a nose sticking out, and it looks like it's turning the other direction. So we, our expectations have actually changed this stimulation, so it will better suit how we would like to see the world. And there are actually a lot of these types of illusions that can show this. But the question now is, can we also manipulate expectations? Can we manipulate how people perceive the world? Can we do, as in the movie The Matrix, give a red or a blue pill and induce two different types of reality. Well, I believe that this is what we doctors do all the time when we induce the placebo effect. And the placebo effect, it's the non-specific effect of a treatment. So it has nothing to do with the pharmacological properties of a substance, but more with how you speak to the patient, how you're dressed, and all the interaction that goes on. So the placebo effect is quite prominent in chronic pain, depression and anxiety, and also in Parkinson's disorder. And the hypothesis we have is that there is an underlying mechanism that is the same for all these different types of placebo effects. And we believe it has something to do with expectations. And when I say expectations, I don't mean only the conscious expectations, I mean expectations of the system, and we'll talk more about that. So let's start with pain. This is, by the way, a self-portrait of Frida Kahlo that was involved in a horrible accident when she was a child. She sat in a tram, and I think she got the iron stick through her body, survived, but had chronic pain the rest of her life. And that's why she portrays herself this way. I'm starting with pain and placebo because we actually know a lot about the placebo effect in general from studies in pain and pain processing. And it all started actually in 1978 when Levine and colleagues actually found out that the opioid system is involved in the placebo effect. So what he did was he pre-treated subjects with naloxone, which is an opioid receptor blocker, which normally would suppress opioid-induced pain reduction, analgesia. But he showed that naloxone also suppresses placebo-induced pain reductions. So that means that the endogenous opioid system must somehow be involved in the placebo response. The second thing we know, which is really important from placebo and pain, is that treatment expectations relate to the placebo effect. And this is from several, you don't see all of them here, but this is from five different studies from the mid-80s to the mid-90s, when they really work with this phenomenon. And it's quite interesting. I will guide you through the setup because it's interesting for the thinking in the rest of the talk. So what it did here, basically, they had subjects coming to the lab. They told them, you will test a new, very potent, pain-reducing cream. But first you will try out the real pain. So what they did first was they stimulated this subject several times with a painful stimulation here. And the subject rated this on a scale, 0 to 100. 100 is the worst pain you can imagine. And she said, it's maybe 75. It's quite painful, actually. Then, after that, the cream was put on. But not only that. The painful stimulation was reduced without the subject knowing about this. And the subject believed that this was a fantastic effect from the cream itself. So he said, or she said, oh, yeah, this is really good. Maybe 25 on the same scale. 0 to 100. After that, the subjects come back, maybe the day later, and they are told that we will do exactly the same thing again. The painful stimulation is induced, but this time it's the same as in the beginning. And the subjects will now rate this maybe 50, somewhere in between. He will say, or she will say, that, wow, yeah, it really works, but maybe not as good as here. But still, it's much lower than here. And this is not the habituation effect, because if you do exactly all this and you tell the subjects what you do, you don't see this. If you all the time have exactly the same stimulation, you don't see this. So this effect is completely dependent on the manipulation here. And also what is more interesting is if the subject's rate before the real placebo test, rate what they expect of the treatment. This treatment expectation will correlate with the subsequent placebo effect. So those who think they will have the best effect will have the best effect. And also it's important to say that there are both verbal induced expectations, so that is we are telling the subjects what will happen, but also implicit expectations that are induced by a conditioning here. So it's all so everything around, all the context around that when this happens will some way affect what happens here, even without the verbal information. We'll be back to that as well. All right, so is this just a report bias? Are the subjects just telling us what we want to hear to please the doctor? Well, probably not. I think that that has been nicely shown in several functional imaging studies now, that because we can directly image what happens in the brain when we process pain. And in a control situation, when we experience pain, we see increased activity in several regions that we know are involved in constructing the experience of pain. However, if we pre-treat these subjects with placebo, these activations are almost gone, and this is just a difference map. So this is the difference between the control state and the placebo state. So it seems that we have more objective ways to show that really we process nociceptor or pain information to a lesser degree in the brain during placebo. All right, we were inspired by the relation between the opioid system and placebo. So we did a study where the subjects were treated sometimes with a short-lasting but quite potent opioid called remifentanil, and sometimes with another very powerful pain-reducing drug, which actually only was saline, that is water and salt, so that was our placebo. And this is what we observed in the brain. First, we observed a huge increase of activity. I have to tell you also, this is a PET study, so it's more the activations are a little bit more spread out than you're used to in fMRI when you see fMRI studies. But however, we observed a huge activation in the anterior cingulate cortex. So this is, as you know, the frontal part of the cortex and the medial part of the cortex, and it looks like a boomerang here. So this is an opioid analgesia effect. The center of mass and the most explicit activation was in this, the rostral part of the anterior cingulate cortex, and it overlapped with a small activation induced by the placebo treatment. We also observed increased activation in the orbitofrontal cortex. So this is the brain from below. This is the prefrontal cortex, and here you see increased activity, especially on the right side, which spreads out also on the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex. And these activations have been reproduced in several different studies, although there are things that can be discussed there, but there's no room for that here today. But in general, we see increased activity in many studies in these areas of the anterior cingulate cortex and in the orbitofrontal cortex during placebo analgesia. So it's a fairly robust effect. All right, so now we'll turn a little bit to depression, anxiety, and emotion. I think that understanding what happens in placebo is even much more important when it comes to these disorders, anxiety and depression, because the placebo effect when you treat subjects with antidepressive treatments is enormous. It has been estimated to be in between 70 to 75% of the whole antidepressive treatment effect. So we need to understand what happens here. But it's quite hard to study this in conditions when you treat subjects for many weeks or months. So we tried to construct an experimental setting where we could study this in a similar way as placebo analgesia has been studied before. So we instead chose to look at the emotional processing in general. And what we did was that we showed the subjects pictures that they were either unpleasant or neutral. I know you don't think this is very unpleasant, and some of you think that this is not neutral, but this is a little bit like Rorschach. You're only allowed to show the worst one. These are actually mutilated bodies, they're catastrophes, they're starving children, they're quite horrible, and these are boring. And we show these pictures in order to induce an experimental emotional state. And also we used, the subjects came 2 different days. Day one, they were given a real anxiety-reducing drug. Day two, they were given placebo. And what happened day one was that they watched a block of pictures like this, then they rated unpleasantness. So this is 51 here in average. Then we treated them with a very small dose of benzodiazepine intravenously. Then they once again looked at very similar types of pictures, and they said, wow, this is not as unpleasant anymore, only rated the unpleasantness to 29. Then we were quite mean to them because we gave them a benzodiazepine blocker, Lanaxate, intravenously, and we made them rate again, and now they perceived the unpleasant pictures as quite unpleasant, actually even a little bit more unpleasant than here. So, why did we do this? Well, we manipulated expectations. Now they believed that we can actually make them experience the unpleasant pictures as less unpleasant after this manipulation. We told them to come back another day because we said we'll do exactly the same thing, but in the MRI scanner. And this time, they watched very similar pictures. They got sometimes information that they're getting the anxiety-reducing drug, and sometimes they got the information that they're getting the control drug, which reverses everything to baseline. And actually, they only get saline in both different conditions, so salt and water. And they still perceived the unpleasant pictures to be less unpleasant when they thought they're getting the anxiety-reducing drug than when they thought that everything was normal. And what happened in the brain? Well, first of all, we observed that the emotional processing in several different areas, including the amygdala here, was decreased when they were treated with a placebo. But what was even more interesting was that we actually could show once again that we have a placebo-dependent increase in the rostral anterior cingulate cortex and in the lateral orbital frontal cortex, actually also here on the right side, quite interestingly, mimicking the activations we observed in placebo analgesia previously. So we can at least generalize these 2 different types of placebo, placebo analgesia and emotional placebo, in the way that it seems at similar, 2 similar regions are involved in both of these types of placebo. So the question is, what do these regions do? Well, let's talk a little bit about the rostral anterior cingulate cortex. So this is our activation in opioid treatment. This is placebo. And if you divided these subjects into responders and non-responders and looked how the brain responded when they were given not placebo but the opioid, you see that the responders activated this area quite profoundly while the non-responders did not activate it at all. And there was a significant difference between these two. And this is just a small post-hoc analysis, but it's quite interesting because it tells us that maybe you have a more effective opioid system if you're a placebo responder. At least you activate it better when you get real opioids. And I think it's even more interesting if I show you this study. So this is a study by Frode Willock and colleagues, and what it shows, this is not a fMRI study, this is actually not even activation study, this is a receptor imaging study. So they're looking, they have opioid tracers, radioactive opioid ligands that they give these subjects, and they look where these ligands bind. So an area that is more red indicates that the concentration is probably larger than in other areas. And if you don't care about these subcortical structures, you see that no other area seems to have as high concentration of opioid receptors as the rostral anterior cingulate cortex. So that's interesting. So maybe we see this large activation because we somehow activate the opioid system when we give opioids. And also in placebo, we know it's the placebo response is associated to the opioid system. So maybe it's not strange that we activate this area, which is full of opioids. And in fact, it has been shown in another type of PET receptor study, imaging study, where they looked more dynamically which areas will activate their opioid systems more during placebo than a control condition. They once again observed that the opioid system in the rostral ACC seems to be more activated during placebo. And also it's well known that there is a quite profound opioid system in the brainstem. However, people have not really talked about what the opioid receptors do in the brain very much. It's not well known why are they in those more complex regions higher up in the hierarchy. Well, our idea was that we don't know, but maybe they interact somehow. Or actually, there was already Focht had this idea, but he didn't apply it to placebo. But we said in placebo, maybe these two areas interact together. So what we did was that we went back to our data, we pulled out the activity in the rostral ACC, in blue here, in the different conditions. So this is opioid analgesia, placebo analgesia, and pain-only condition. Then we correlated it with the rest of the brain. And what we could see was a functional relation between the rostral ACC and the brainstem in the opioid analgesia, in placebo analgesia, but not in the pain-only condition. And actually, it has been shown in a study by Christian Büchel's group that the interaction between this area in the anterior cingulate cortex and the brainstem is naloxone dependent. So if you pre-treat subjects with opioid receptor blocker, you don't see any such interaction. So it seems that the different opioid networks in the brainstem and in the cortex interact during placebo. All right. If you would ask most people working with cognitive neuroscience about the anterior cingulate cortex and what it does, probably 1% would say it's involved in pain. So pain seems not to be a major feature of the anterior cingulate cortex. Probably even fewer would say that the opioid system that is important for the opioid system, because the anterior cingulate cortex has been implemented in attention and executive functions, the different ideas exactly what it does. But what we do know is that the posterior part seems to be much more in non-emotional cognitive processes, while the anterior part, or the rostral anterior cingulate cortex, seems to be much more involved in emotional processes. And in fact, several studies, including this one, has shown that when we need to regulate emotions, it seems to be more active than otherwise. So in this case, the subjects were shown, this is a study by Etkin and colleagues, and fearful or faces with different emotional expressions were shown. The task was to quickly say what type of expression the face had. In this case, it's easy because it's a fearful face, and there's a word here saying fear. So it's a congruent case, right? And you're very quick to respond to this. But in this case, you're supposed to say fear, it's a fearful face, but the word is happy. That's really hard. That makes it much harder to say. It takes longer time, you do more mistakes, but if you do this several times, you get better at this. And what you see when you look at activity in the brain is increased activity in the rostral anterior cingulate cortex, which also seems to modulate amygdala, which is one of these emotional regions. So it seems to have a regulatory function. And this is our idea as well in placebo analgesia. We believe that the rostral anterior cingulate cortex is involved in an interaction between attentional processes and the opioid system. So we believe that attentional processes can use the opioid system in order to regulate pain. All right, what about the orbitofrontal cortex? Well, this is an even more exciting area, even more hard to study, and there are a lot of ideas of what it actually does, and some of them are in conflict with each other. This is the activation we observed in placebo analgesia in the orbitofrontal cortex. The interesting point with this activation, you don't see it really well here, but the interesting point with the orbitofrontal activation is that this activity is larger, it's stronger in the placebo condition compared to the opioid condition. So this is extremely interesting, because all medical companies say that placebo is a passive control. And here we show, no, it's not. It has activations, and this is not smaller activations in the opioid condition. This is real activations that you see in the placebo condition that don't exist in the real drug condition. All right, so what does this area do? Well, this is one idea, which is quite debated by Schobaum and colleagues, but what he says is that possibly it will somehow shape our motivational homeostatic goals and also emotional goals. And he says that when rats are really, really thirsty and you measure the activity in the orbitofrontal cortex, you see quite a profound activation. Until they find the water, then the activation disappears. So he says that it is like it's driving and a behavior in order to accomplish a homeostatic goal. I know that this has not been shown in primates, so the last word is not said yet when it comes to this. But it seems that it's involved registering rewards. So this is also activity in orbitofrontal neurons in a primate, and here the primate has been given a reward. But also it registers reward expectations. So this signal symbolizes that soon there will be a reward, and here you see a large activation in the orbitofrontal cortex. And this is quite interesting, because here we talk about expectations again. And finally, something which I think is quite interesting, is that it seems to process what is called an aversive error signal. So I'm really sorry about this. You don't see the references. They are a little bit below there, but they are actually here. This is by Ben Seymour and colleagues. And in this study, the aversive error signal can be described as a difference between what you expect when you expect that something will be better and what you get when it actually gets worse. So what he did in this study was that they induced a tonic pain that was ongoing, and then they got a signal that the pain will probably decrease, but what actually happened was that the pain increased instead. So there's a huge difference between the expectations and what you really get, and that one is called the aversive error signal, and it's expressed bilaterally in the orbitofrontal cortex. So it seems that the orbitofrontal cortex is computing different processes which might be very important for the placebo effect. So it maybe involves emotional goals. It certainly involves reward expectations, emotional tracking, so knowing when it's a reward, for instance, and aversive error signals. All right. So if we are right that these two regions are important in placebo, and that they work together, we must be able to show that they work together as well. So we actually went back to our data only to also show very specifically if the Rostal ACC interacts with this area, if there's a functional connectivity that is specific for placebo. And in the PET study, we observed that the Rostal ACC has a placebo-specific functional connectivity with this area, a part of the activation we observed in the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex and orbitofrontal cortex. But we didn't show anything like this in the drug condition, so it was placebo-specific. In the other study, the emotional placebo study, we could show that for each subject there was a functional connectivity between these two areas, and this functional connectivity was related to the degree of placebo effect we were able to induce. So the best placebo responders, so out here somewhere, they had the highest functional relation between these two areas. So it seems that the interaction between the rostral ACC and the orbital frontal cortex is directly important for the placebo effect. Right, so now we go to the simple question. Why do we actually have a placebo response? Well, we believe, our hypothesis is, that the placebo effect is just a consequence of a system that tries to understand and predict what happens in the world. And this is our very simple schedule. And of course, this is not unique to placebo. I'm sure that Professor Dehaene has talked about, a lot about expectations and error signals and so on. But this is how what we believe happens in a placebo condition. So we induce a treatment expectation. We tell the subjects that this drug is really, really good. It will decrease your pain. You will almost not feel any pain at all. Anyway, nociceptive signals or pain signals still reach the brain. And that doesn't match with the expectation, does it? So what happens now is that an error signal is produced, which the brain does all the time for everything. But when an error signal is produced, this means that we haven't really understood the world the right way. So the best way to try to understand the world is to compromise and minimize this error. And we can actually do two different things. We can change the treatment expectations so it better suits the incoming signals. But many times, these expectations are very important for understanding the world, and they're actually more true than the signals that reach the brain. So we can also modulate how we process the input through top-down regulation. And we believe that this is actually what is the placebo effect in pain. And I've already shown that the processing of error signals and treatment expectations happens in the orbital frontal cortex, and also that you have top-down regulation from the rostral anterior cingulate cortex that seems to be important, at least in emotional processing and in pain processing. Okay, so far we've only talked, you don't see this either, but it should say internal signals. So that is signals from the body. And those are processed in a hierarchy in the brain, and those are probably also involved in what we call emotions. And the highest part here in this hierarchy is the orbital frontal cortex, I would say, and the rostral anterior cingulate cortex. If we generalize the idea about placebo, we should therefore be able to see it not only for suppression, like we've seen in placebo analgesia, we should be able to increase pain by using expectations. And this is a well-known phenomenon. It's called nocebo or nocebo hyperalgesia. And what happens in nocebo? Well, first of all, it seems to be associated not to the opioid system, but to another system, the CCK system, or cholecystokinin system. So it's interesting because these two systems are antagonistic in many different ways. So CCK will, for instance, induce anxiety in people, while opioids will induce well-being. But also they seem to be antagonistic in nocebo versus placebo. So in this case, the subjects have been are in pain here, and in this experimental pain, and here nothing is done. Here, saline is given, and they are told that this will increase your pain. It really does. And here, larger doses of Proglomid is given, which blocks the CCK system, and you can see that the nocebo effect decreases. Also, new data shows that we seem to have an overlapping activation in the placebo condition and also in the nocebo condition, the rostral ACC. So the idea is actually that we have is that this part of the brain can use different systems to manipulate if it wants to achieve different goals. Also, another study by Kong and colleagues have shown that the orbitofrontal cortex also is involved in nocebo. However, what is quite interesting is that it does exactly the opposite thing. The more, the larger the nocebo effect is induced, the lower is the activity in the orbitofrontal cortex. So this is in line with the idea of this region being important of the aversive error signal. This does exactly the opposite compared to placebo. So this is what we would like to find if the model is true. All right, so we've been talking about internal signals so far, but if we should generalize this even more, we should be able to see exactly the same type of phenomenon in processing the external signals from the outer world, including vision and auditory stimulation. And that's it seems that you have a parallel hierarchy that does similar things. And the top of this hierarchy, I would say, is the caudal anterior cingulate cortex and the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And so we have another dimension which is interesting here. We've been talking about internal signals previously, but now we want to generalize this to external signals as well. So we try to do this using a visual illusion task called a random dot kinetogram. And I will walk you through this a little bit. So the subjects looked at a computer screen with dots that were blinking in a very special way. So it became an illusion, and they perceived this as a cylinder that is rotating, either to one direction or to the other direction. But it's an instable visual stimulation, so it jumps between these different two perceptions. Now, if you make them indicate when it rotates to the left and to the right side, it's almost as much to both sides. Now we wanted to construct this exactly like we constructed the placebo experiments before. So we wanted actually to have an expectation manipulation phase. And therefore, we gave them red-green glasses, and we told them that this illusion will change, so you will see a rotation much more towards the red glass. But what they didn't know was that we also change this stimulation onto 3D cues, and that made it possible for us to make a real rotation. So everyone experienced the same thing. And as you can see here, we made them perceive this mostly to the right side and the red glass, and then they switched sides of glasses, and now they perceive the rotation much more towards the left side where the red glass is. After that, they rested for 5 minutes, and then we said, we will do this again. And we really did, but this time we used the same stimulation as in the beginning, the real instable stimulation. And what happened here was they perceived it almost exactly like here, because they had red-green glasses and everything looks red-green, so it wasn't a problem. But also what happened was that they perceived the rotation to be much more towards the red side here, and towards the right, and they switched glasses and they perceived it towards left where the red glasses were now. Then they took off the glasses and you see no difference in the different rotations. So the idea here is that the expectations that we manipulated here should directly change how you perceive this visual illusion here. Now, there is a confound here, and it's called the Pullrich effect. So it is about that you actually see different depths depending on the green and red glass. So we have redone this experiment with a completely different way, with mirror stereoscopes, which are not dependent on red-green glasses, and we have actually gotten exactly the same results. So it seems to be true. So I would say that this suggests that we can really generalize the idea of placebo also to external visual input to the brain. However, we are doing experiments now with fMRI, but we are not done yet, so we don't know if these regions are involved. But if you look at other experiments, like Paul Fletcher, who has been here before, who looks at complex associative learning, it involves complex expectations and error signal, and both are expressed in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and also in the caudal anterior cingulate cortex. And what is quite interesting with that is also that psychotic patients have a smaller error signal. And since psychosis is related to a change in how we perceive reality, I think this is quite an interesting finding. Right, so another dimension I want to talk about, high hierarchy versus low hierarchy. So we believe that the conscious manifestations of a placebo effect have more to do with the involvement of higher hierarchies, and the non-conscious manifestation has more to do with the lower hierarchy processes. And of course, this is illustrated here by conditioning and Pavlov's dogs. And do we have a conditioning effect in placebo? Well, I believe so. So this beautiful study by Fabrizio Benedetti has tried to show that, for instance. So this is four different groups of subjects that do different things. All of them perceive a painful stimulation. It's a cuff pain, so it's a pain around, it's a pressure around your arm, and you have to do this many times. And it's really, really painful after a while. And then he measures how much can you tolerate this. So this is day one, day two, day three, day four, day five. So day one, they tolerated just 13 minutes, this group. Day two, they get a small dose of morphine intravenously. And now they tolerate this much, much longer, 26 minutes. Day three, exactly the same thing happens. They tolerated 28 minutes. Day four, they are told they receive morphine, but they don't receive morphine. They receive saline. They still tolerate it much longer than here. Day five, they get nothing. They don't tolerate it anymore, better than nothing, than the first day. So this seems to be a placebo effect. If you do exactly the same thing, like in this group, but you change the saline to naloxone instead, which blocks the opioid receptors, this effect is abolished. Now, the interesting part. Here, for this group, the same thing was done. Day one, nothing. Day two, morphine. Day three, morphine. Day four, saline, with one difference. They were told this is saline. So no one thought it was morphine. We should not have any effect, right? What happens? You still have a significant effect. This can only be explained by a conditioning day two and day three with morphine. When you do exactly the same thing and you treat them with naloxone as well, this effect is abolished. Conditioning effects have also been shown in both animals and humans in hormonal systems. So this is, for instance, a study where humans received sumatriptane intravenously, which decreases... Let's see now, sorry. This is the wrong picture, but doesn't matter. It's the same one as the one I wanted to say. It should decrease the cortisol. So this is GH, we can take that one. This one should increase GH, and it does that after sumatriptane treatment. Day two, the same thing happens. Day three, they believe it's sumatriptane, but it's not. It's only a placebo. It's saline intravenously, but there's still an increase in GH. And they are also suggested these days that there will be a GH increase. This group, you do exactly the same thing, but the suggestion here is that it should be a decrease of GH. That doesn't have any effect because it will still be an increase. So it's only a conditioning effect that we see here in the hormonal system. And I think the most intriguing studies have been done on placebo and the immune system, actually. And there are some fantastically interesting studies on rats, where these rats have actually had a graft transplantation. They have an extra heart. It's a transplantation model of rats. And so you can really see how long will this heart survive, because when it doesn't survive any longer, it stops beating. So it's a very simple model for transplantation surgeons that they use. And this heart will survive longer if you give the rat's immunosuppressive substances, because it's the immune system that will kill the heart. Now, what they've done here is that given immunosuppressive substances a couple of days, but then after that, they have given it the same blue and sweet liquid as they got before with the immunosuppressive, but without it. And still, the heart survived much longer than if you don't give anything at all. So it's a fantastic experiment where they show that even heart survival can depend on conditioning effects. Right, so I think this is a beautiful review by Professor De Haan, and of course he talks about the consciousness and the global workspace is important, and you have prefrontal areas as well involved in conscious experiences. If you have unconscious experience, like masked words, you will have a local activity, but you won't have the activity of the whole global workspace. And the idea we have is that this probably has more to do with the conscious part of the placebo effects, but the expectation-like effects, like condition, can also happen in very, very local areas. And this is the model by Carl Friston and colleagues. I won't go through it at all. And the only thing I want to say is that this model about brain function considers both input to the brain and expectation. But the interesting thing in the model is that he says that this happens in lower systems, but it also happens in higher cortical systems. So if we are right about our model for placebo analgesia, this is why we could have conditioning effects like on very, very low levels, but we could also have conscious placebo effects on these higher levels and when we have the whole Vogel global workspace activated. All right, so we'll turn to the last clinical state. This is Parkinson's disorder. And Parkinson's disorder, of course, has to do with the dopamine system and the motor and motor behavior. And the placebo effect in Parkinson's is also quite large. And it has been shown, apart from the objective finding that they actually improve in their motor behavior, it has also been shown that things happen in the brain. So if you do a receptor imaging PET of the dopamine system this time, you will see that there's a lot of dopamine in the basal ganglia, shown here and here. After, this is baseline, after placebo treatment, you see that this signal is much weaker. And when you have a weaker signal, it indicates they have a stronger endogenous dopamine activity. So only believing that they get L-DOPA will make them activate or will boost their own dopamine system. Another finding that has been shown is when they've done deep brain stimulation in Parkinson patients in nucleus subthalamicus, this nucleus shows normally a very pathological high-frequency activity in Parkinson, but after placebo treatment, this activity is more or less gone. So they're quite nice objective findings in Parkinson. But the important point here is that the dopamine system is involved in Parkinson. And you don't see it here, it says down here, but the dopamine system is also involved in reward processing, expectations, and error signaling. Exactly what we've been talking about in placebo. So it's a highly interesting system for placebo in general. And similar to the Parkinson's patients, we can do similar experiments with healthy subjects. If we give them amphetamine, which releases dopamine, which is very similar in that way, it will boost the dopamine system, as when you give L-DOPA to Parkinson patients, you will see increases in the dopamine system in the basal ganglia, shown here. If you give them placebo, they think they're getting this amphetamine. This will still, this has been after that they've tried amphetamine, this will still activate the dopamine system in the basal ganglia. So only believing that you will get something that will boost your dopamine system will boost your dopamine system. And finally, Zubieta and his group has actually shown that we do have a co-activation of opioid and dopamine system in placebo analgesia at least in the basal ganglia. So this is a dopamine, this is opioid activations in basal ganglia, and these are dopamine activations. So they both co-occur, and it seems that both are important for placebo analgesia. All right, so I've been talking about these different dimensions in placebo and expectations, that you were able to suppress this, like in placebo analgesia, you're able to increase the processing, like in nocebo hyperalgesia. The placebo effect can be shown in internal signals like pain, emotion, depression, but also external signals, like visual and auditory system seems to be dependent on expectations. And I mean, there are a lot of studies on this, actually. We just tried to make it similar, to make an experiment that is similar to our placebo experiments. But there's a lot of studies on this effect. And also, we have the idea that there's a dimension between high hierarchies where you have conscious manifestation and low hierarchies where you have non-conscious manifestations. We have tried to show that expectation seems to be important, and very possibly the dopamine system is involved somehow in driving these expectations. And we believe that this is what actually drives all the different type of placebo effects that we see. Directly in Parkinson disorder, indirectly through the opioid system in placebo analgesia. We don't know exactly how it happens in emotional placebo, possibly serotonin system, possibly opioid system, we don't know. And I want to leave you with a couple of final slides, which have to do about the expectation of stability in the external world. So if I turn my back like this and then turn back like this, I don't expect to see 200 ice bears. I expect you to sit here still, right? So we have expectation that the external world should not change very much if we are away for a little while and then come back again. So what happens when you play around with expectations, you manipulate expectations and the other parts of this scheme here? Well, first of all, I want to show you this study by Andreas Olsson. So, by the way, I have to say, this is a very dear colleague of mine, also working at Karolinska Institute, and I envy him all the time, because he actually made it to science by using two cards, and that is the best cost effectiveness I've ever seen. So basically what they did here, they had male subjects and they showed them either a female face, two different female faces, and they asked the subjects, which face do you think is most attractive? These subjects point to this face, the cards are put down like this, the card he chose is slided over like this, he picks up the card and he's asked, why did you choose that face? And the different subjects have different things, but basically they say things like, well, I could see directly that she's a very beautiful girl. She has the eyes I really like. She looks like my girlfriend. She would be the girl I would approach in a bar, etc. The only problem is that they are talking about the wrong woman. So this is a trick. So they actually see this woman. So I would say that this is experimentally induced confabulations. And I believe that this has to do with stability of the world. They have done an action. They have had control of everything. They know they've chosen that card. So that information, which is completely wrong, does not match their expectation, so which are really, really strong. So the information that is wrong is wrong. And instead, we change everything and confabulate a little bit. And I will show you another one. This one is on inattentional blindness. And this is what I usually say that psychologists do when they want to have fun. This is the experimental leader, and this is the subject he found on the street. And now you'll see what happens. Oops, sorry. Let's see. No? Please, please work. I think we'll try another one. All right. So he's trying to tell him where he should find this this place he's asking for. And now something special happens. And he was looking at him to see. So they changed the experimental leader. He doesn't notice anything at all. And I can tell you, this happens in more than 60% of all the people they try to do this experiment with, where they ask them afterwards, and it seems to happen in this woman as well. And when they ask them afterwards, they had no idea that they changed the persons. They have no idea. This guy will even stare at him in a few seconds, and he doesn't see anything, that anything has changed. So you don't expect a subject to become another subject in such a situation. Your expectations of the stability in the world are extremely strong. And if you don't think this is fun, you should actually look on the internet and look on BBC and inattentional blindness, and you will see a woman become a man and a white guy become a black guy without that the subject sees that. Thank you very much for your attention.